It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. The governor's task force on broadband access is in its third year of work with more than two dozen members and a new chair. We look at what's next for this committee as the Wisconsin Broadband Office estimates 650,000 people in our state lack high-speed internet access. Governor Tony Evers at yesterday's inaugural address.
If we do not close that digital divide, Wisconsinites will be left behind. So we must ensure that every kid, every family, every business, and every hospital can get connected to affordable, reliable, high-speed internet. Together, we will do that.
Join in with your questions about broadband, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chris Meyer is chair of the Governor's Task Force on Broadband Access. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good morning. You just heard the governor there in the inaugural address talking about broadband. Anything stand out to you first?
You know, I think one of the things that certainly stands out is Governor Tony Evers has continued to be very supportive of broadband, as have so many elected officials across the state, across the aisle. And it underscores the importance of getting everybody connected. So we're really excited to be kicking off our third year in the Broadband Task Force and here today talking about some of the things we're going to need some help with from the residents of Wisconsin.
Well, let's start with that first deadline from the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, seeking comment on its new draft broadband coverage maps across the country. And residents have until January 13th, just over a week, to comment on the maps. Why are accurate maps so important?
Yeah, well, you know, the Governor's Broadband Task Force has been meeting for the last 2 years. And in each meeting, we discuss a number of issues around broadband. But one common theme at every meeting I've ever been at is the lack of good maps to understand where we have broadband and where we do not. To be clear, we have maps. The FCC has maps that they've had for many years that will tell you if you have or should have internet service at your residence or at your business. However, historically, that data has been allocated at the census block level. So if you think about a one square country mile in northern Wisconsin, if one person in the southwest corner has internet, the whole block shows that people have internet, even though you know the person across the street or just down the road may not be able to get the same service you do. So maps were highly inaccurate. And the FCC has released some new maps now that are built using carrier data and give residents and business owners, all of us, the ability to go and look at our own physical address and look to see what services are available to us. And we can challenge that, meaning that if we say, hey, that's not right, the FCC really doesn't have this right, we can challenge that. And that's what we're asking people to do here before the 13th is look at their home, look at their business, and make sure the information on the FCC map is accurate. And to find that information, you just need to go to broadbandmap.fcc.gov and type in your address.
And we're going to get more details on that work of the challenges part in a moment. But can you explain, when you look at this new map, what does it say about Wisconsin broadband coverage? What do you see?
Well, you know, a couple of things there. First and foremost, if you look at the map and you include satellite coverage, it looks like Wisconsin has pretty good coverage across the state. But one of the important things the governor said in his address yesterday is that we need accessible, affordable internet service. And affordable is a really key word here. So many Wisconsinites can't afford the high cost of satellite. And there are some concerns about resiliency or availability of satellite services, especially in bad weather. If you recall, earlier this year, SpaceX had requested $1 billion in subsidies to offset the cost of their internet service to Americans, and the federal government through the FCC declined that, stating that they weren't able to provide quality of service data, meaning guarantees that their service would always be available and working. So you can see both satellite data, you can see your fixed wireless data, your fixed data. So any of the services that are coming to your house across a phone line or a coax cable, mm-hmm. You can even see cellular services. So you can look at all the different services that are available in your area, look at what's available, make sure your house is listed, And then if there's anything missing, it's very easy to challenge that. There's directions on the broadbandmap.fcc.gov website on how to challenge these things. And we encourage residents to, of course, do that before the 13th.
I'm going to pause here and reintroduce you. Chris Meyer with us as we talk about internet access in Wisconsin, new chair of the Governor's Task Force on Broadband Access. You can join in at 800-642-1234. George in Ashland. Go ahead, George. Hi.
Hi. Well, I appreciate the comments about the differentiation between satellite service and cable service. I'm here in rural Ashland, Wisconsin. We're having a blizzard. So, you know, there's no internet service, even though satellite service can be pretty high speed, but it's not available. And you're in a big storm and you're snowed in or your roads are washed out. It's not very reliable. So I really appreciate the commentary along those lines. Thank you.
George, while you're on the line, what would a solution look like to you, especially as you face, you know, extreme weather events and internet goes down?
Well, the availability here in Ashland County of fiber optic and Bayfield County fiber optic, these areas in northern Wisconsin, it's very scattered. So some places have, in very rural locations, have excellent fiber optic service, and others just have no availability to that. So you're left with whatever your other options might be. And for most of these rural areas, it's probably the most reliable option is satellite, which is, but of course, in bad weather, it's not, you know, it's mm-hmm. just not there.
George, thank you for that. Chris, what do you make of this patchwork that George describes?
He's 100% accurate. And that's really the work that we're focused on trying to, what we're trying to improve with the Governor's Broadband Task Force. We know that, you know, fiber is a great solution as far as speed and reliability go. It's not affected by the snow or the weather. You can put lots and lots of data across it, but it's also expensive. And there are some areas where it's not cost effective to use, but we do want to make sure we're prioritizing those types of technologies, fiber optic cables, when they're appropriate, so that we can have higher access to these services in the areas that are served. The caller mentioned a few sites up north. There are some areas up north that have better internet service in a very rural community than Madison or Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, just down the road a mile or two, there's communities that don't have any internet access or very limited access. So it is very haphazard. And that's one of the things the Governor's Broadband Task Force is really focused on, is trying to level the playing field and make sure that one of the things we talk a lot about is digital equity, making sure everyone has access to the services we really need today, including internet service.
I want to go back on the maps that the FCC has put forth and kind of this crowdsourcing approach as people, you know, put in their addresses and such. And the Public Service Commission has commented on 7,000, identified 7,000 locations that are not even on the new FCC map. What problems are being identified here?
So the map data today, the new data, was collected from internet service providers and others to congregate or to bring all this data together to create these maps. Obviously, there's sometimes errors, and that's what we're looking for now. So the Public Service Commission, the Office of Broadband, has submitted a challenge on some of what we call the fabric of the data. And that includes locations, around 7,000 locations that are either inaccurate or missing on the maps. And those are the same things we're looking for residents to also verify, looking at their address and saying, hey, I'm not even listed. I'm going to create a challenge to say, you need to list me on the map.
Are there any improvements that would make the FCC process on getting these maps as good as they can be and for reviewing them? What is this the best route forward? And is it enough time for people to weigh in?
So there is a deadline on the 13th. I think one of the important things to remember here is that these maps are new, right? And mm-hmm. it's a new process. The maps in the past were updated infrequently. I always said that by the time they did get updated within a week, they were outdated already, and it'd be a year before they were updated again. There will be other iterations where people are able to challenge these maps in the future. There will be ongoing improvements to the map in the future. This is the first iteration, and that's why it's so important this time to make sure that all of our locations are accurate, all of our homes are listed, because in the next year, we expect some significant funds to be coming from the federal government through the Federal Communications Commission. And those funds are going to be allocated based on need. And so if we aren't, it's much like the U.S. Census we do every 10 years. If we're not accurate in our accounting of where our underserved and unserved areas of broadband are, we could miss out on federal dollars.
Chris Meyer chairs the Governor's Task Force on Broadband Access, a committee that's in its third year of work to improve high-speed internet connectivity in our state. Colin, about broadband where you are, what you've experienced, what do you want the task force members to know and prioritize? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We look at the work to expand high-speed internet in Wisconsin, tracing the federal and state dollars, millions of dollars earmarked for this issue, and the work ahead for the Governor's Task Force on Broadband Access. Join in with your questions about broadband. What options you have? Have you looked at the FCC maps? Call in at 800-642-1234. We have Chris Meyer, chairs the task force and stays with us. Let's go to Jason in Appleton. Jason, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hey, good morning. Great conversation. So over the last five, first of all, I'm in the technology field, in the internet field, and I've actually been in the SpaceX factories, and I've lived remotely for 5 years now. I've been dealing with this and have gone through every different avenue to get internet. And I want to make a couple of points. One is that there's differences between satellite technology. There is deep space satellite, which has very high latency. It's very expensive, and the quality is quite low. And then there's low Earth orbit technology, which is Starlink and SpaceX, which I've also used for several years and was one of the first beta customers. And the quality is much higher, and it's much more reliable and affordable and usable. But there are some limitations with visibility to the sky and the ability to be able to see the sky if you're, you know, surrounded by woods. And so the comment that I would make to everyone, and I also now have fiber. I've worked with the local installer. I'm not too far outside of town, and they've just now installed fiber for my residence. And so the point I'd like to make to everyone is that there are different types of internet, and that the best thing that we all can do is to put our data into the maps to let the government know who needs it, and then so that we can get as much funding as possible to help your local installers and to help companies like SpaceX get additional satellites up into the air to help us. And then also know who your representatives are that are voting for these bills to get as much funding to rural Wisconsin as possible.
Jason, appreciate the call and appreciate your firsthand user experience there. Chris, what stands out to you in Jason's comments?
Well, he's right. And it's a good clarification to make, Jason, about the very differences in internet service, because a service like Starlink, which uses low Earth orbiting satellites and fiber relays on the ground to send data back and forth, is much more reliable. As you pointed out, though, one of the challenges that I think of George up in Ashland, who just called before, is snow and weather. And I know that when I get my snow blower out to take care of 2 or 3 inches of snow, George has probably got 2 or 3 feet of snow up where he is. And so I suspect that that's the biggest barrier to services like Starlink, in addition to the fact that it is very expensive. And for a lot of Wisconsinites, especially seniors, $110 a month cost for internet service is not sustainable for them. But there are options out there, absolutely. And Starlink can be one of those, as well as some other internet services. But as far as the expansion of broadband across the state is concerned, we are not considering satellite service of any kind to be a gap filler, meaning that is not something that we're looking at. We're looking purely at those fixed point wireless and fiber optic runs for broadband service.
Okay, good to know. Jason mentioned this, you did as well, federal grant money coming down the pike, and Wisconsin expected to get at least $100 million in federal grant dollars to expand broadband this summer. Who decides how this money is spent and where it goes?
Yeah, great question. And in addition to that funding, again, with these maps, we're looking at funding down the road here in the next year or so, and we'll know this coming June, how many hundreds of millions of dollars may be coming to Wisconsin. We expect between $700 million and $1.1 billion dedicated to broadband expansion. How those funds are used is an important question. Public Service Commission is a public entity. The Office of Broadband certainly operates under them. And these are federal dollars. So no doubt there are a lot of rules from the NTIA on how exactly these funds can be allocated. Currently, the broadband office is working through those early stages of planning. Certainly, we're going to be following all the federal rules. And most importantly, this will all be done in public because the Public Service Commission is a public entity. And so this will be done through a grant process like it has in the past. And the grant program with the state broadband office has been recognized nationally as best in class as an organization, how they document and facilitate their award program. And just since 2019, when Governor Evers took office, there's been $300 million deployed, almost $300 million deployed to broadband expansion throughout the state of Wisconsin, which has connected about another 387,000 homes. But as you pointed out, when we look at the maps today, there's a disconnect between the number of folks that look like they don't have service and those that we believe don't really have service, those fixed point wireless or fiber services. We believe there's around 220,000 unserved locations in Wisconsin and about 500 underserved. And underserved and unserved are two different terms, but they're basically one means there's no service available at all that meets the standard of broadband, which is 25 meg down, 3 meg up. And underserved means you can't get service at 100 meg by 20 meg down. So we're really focused on the unserved areas here to start because those are the folks that need the most help. And these broadband maps are going to be absolutely essential to making sure we know where the locations are that need service and that we're getting the money from the federal government to implement that service.
Governor's Task Force on Broadband Access, new chair Chris Meyer with us as we talk about internet access in our state, the new FCC maps. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Chris, I want to shine a light on the work of the task force now, created by an executive order in the summer of 2020, the goal of developing strategies to expand access. As you look back at the work, what stands out as the most important accomplishment for the task force?
Well, I think the most important accomplishment is those 387,000 homes that have gotten connected, and we've still got more work to do. But one of the things that I can say about the broadband task force is that it's a pretty incredible group of volunteers, people from across the state, from higher education and business, and of course, internet service providers, all coming together to try and solve a problem for the state of Wisconsin. Over that time, we've done a remarkable amount of work in expanding broadband throughout the state. As I said, a lot of room yet to go. What I think I'm most excited about is the future of the broadband task force. We've clearly articulated the need, but now as funding starts to come in from the federal government, there's a need to create some extensive plans for how it is we're going to deploy those funds. And as important as anything is making sure that we're doing it in a way that's not only covering those underserved areas, but doing it in a way that makes it equitable and accessible to people. It doesn't do us any good to put internet service into a community if it's going to cost $150 a month for a person to subscribe to it. It's got to be affordable, and we've got to make it so that every Wisconsinite, if they choose to, can get access, high-speed, reliable access to the internet.
When you look at the role of this task force as volunteers, as an advisory body, are lawmakers, are regulators taking the advice of the task force to heart?
Oh, they absolutely are. And again, this is one of those things that's kind of fun to work on in politics because it's really bipartisan, right? Nobody thinks that internet access isn't important. Everybody knows that it's important, whether it's for kids who are remote learning, for adults who are remote working, just to participate in the global economy and be able to order something on Amazon if you need to. So expanding broadband clearly is the piece that everybody can get behind and agree on in the world of politics. And our legislature and the governor have continued to allocate funding and continue to be supportive of projects. I've seen them at a number of events for broadband. We've got great participation from our legislative liaisons on the broadband task force. And to a T, everyone is excited about the work we're doing. Of course, there's some differences in how that's going to be deployed and what we may need to do and where we may need to focus those dollars, but that's the work that we'll be defining over the next several months.
Yeah, because there has been concerns in the past that the CARES Act and the ARPA funds that went toward broadband, there have been concerns about accountability and documentation. Going forward, will though there be changes in how these grants are documented?
Yeah, those are work. That's work the Broadband Task Force continues to work on. But you're right. There's been a lot of frustration, really, around if we put $1 billion into the economy to solve a problem, why does it feel like we've only got $200 million in impact? Making sure that we're awarding grants to areas that are going to have the most impact, to those underserved areas. Making sure we're awarding grants that are putting technologies into the ground or onto poles that are going to be the most resilient long-term, so that we have good, reliable long-term solutions in place. Those are things the broadband office will be doing along with the state legislature. Early in the first 2 years of the broadband task force, we talked a lot about barriers to efficiency, right? The fact that a city, if you open up your public right of way to put fiber in the ground, you have to notice the public. And that means others can say, hey, I wanna put fiber in the ground too. But if a private telecom wants to put fiber in the ground, they can come through, trench it, and put it in and not tell anybody. And that's an opportunity to get more data cable in the ground, a dig once policy. So looking at different policies like that and providing some suggestions to the federal or to the state government on ways that they could improve the expansion of broadband is something we'll continue to do as well.
Chris, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure.
Chris Meyer, chair of the Governor's Task Force on Broadband and Access. We have a link to its landing page. Find it at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a comeback story about a special band of horses.
Thousands of Ojibwe horses once roamed in the northern United States and Canada in the early 20th century, but the rare breed almost disappeared by the late 1970s. Then recently, a descendant of the White Earth Nation rescued six Ojibwe horses and gave them a home in northwestern Wisconsin. WPR's Danielle Kading brings us this story about Emily Lorzel and the Humble Horse Organization, which aims to keep the rare breed alive.
I know, Mama. Wuju and Dinoe Maganaduk, Na Damage Kwe Indigenous Kaz, Wabanisi and Dodem, White Earth Indigenous Kaz. Meet you or Ojibwe Anishinaabe Kwe, meet you. So that's a traditional Ojibwe protocol greeting. My name is Emma Lorzel. I founded this, and my husband and I, we both live on site, so we attend to all of the daily needs of the herd, including things like fundraising and outreach and stuff like that. But it's a volunteer-ran organization, so we don't get paid for anything that we do. All the donations go straight back for the horses. A part of our mission here at the Humble Horse is to preserve the breed and to hopefully one day repatriate them back to Anishinaabe communities.
Itchy.
In Anishinaabe culture, if you don't have a name, your ancestors can't find you, so we gave everybody Anishinaabe names. That's Nojimo, or we call her Jimmy, and that's Dimi, but we call her Mama, and then there's Baswewe, which is Echo, and then this is Nimki, who I guarantee you, once you start giving him pets, he will stalk you to the end of days, because he is like, hi, Mama, just the friendliest. I have an Auntie Siobhan Marks and a Uncle Mark Denning. Uncle Mark actually grew up with these horses, or he grew up with ponies, these small little ponies in the forest, right? I learned about these horses from him, and he would always tell me that his dream was to see these horses back in Wisconsin, because as he was growing up with them, they eventually kind of disappeared. What we do know is there were only about four left in 1976. The last stallion was shot by a non-Indigenous researcher who thought he was a moose in the 1960s. So with only four mares left in 1976, and the Canadian government saying, these guys are a public nuisance, we're going to destroy them, four members from Fort Boyce and Lac La Croix Nations got together in the middle of the night, loaded these four mares up onto a horse trailer, actually border hopped over the ice. It's called Heist Across the Ice. And they found sanctuary in a farm in Minnesota. They were able to repopulate, and they were crossbred with a Spanish Mustang that was kind of the most phenotypically similar to the breed. So all of the horses today are related to those four mares. I didn't know we had horses until I was in my early 20s. And why is it that I didn't know about these horses until I was that age? These horses were so vital to our survival. And it, what's cool about it is it was a consensual relationship. We didn't have to keep them penned up. They would come back every year around the winter to help us check trap lines, haul logs. There's even stories of them pawing through ice to help with ice fishing. So because they helped Anishinaabe people survive and we consider them a relative, I guess my question would be, wouldn't you help your relative survive?
WPR's Danielle Kading brought us that story on Ojibwe horses. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to what's known as the fake elector scheme. In a study of Wisconsin, this was the plan to reverse the outcome of the 2020 election, targeting seven swing states, including Wisconsin, where a slate of false electors were created, pledging support to former President Donald Trump in states he lost. The study explores a path for additional state criminal prosecutions. Join in on the fake electors tactic, how you want state law enforcement officials to handle it. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Shan Wu is a white-collar criminal defense attorney, former federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C., co-authored the report called Wisconsin Case Study, The Potential for State Prosecutions of False Electors. Shan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
The fake elector scheme attempted unsuccessfully in seven swing states. Why did you focus on examining Wisconsin?
Well, Wisconsin was one of the swing states, of course, and was important. And it seemed that the particular laws that we looked at were a good template for how different state laws could be used to criminally prosecute. That could be in conjunction with a federal prosecution as well, but it seemed like a good example. And it's, of course, you know, we're not prosecutors anymore. I'm not, and we're not Wisconsin prosecutors, but the idea was to pick an important state and show that there are existing tools that could be used.
Hours after the state Supreme Court confirmed Joe Biden's victory in Wisconsin, 10 Republicans presented themselves as a slate for Donald Trump. Can you explain, I mean, because you said that there are potentially numerous violations here, how do you see these individuals breaking state law?
Sure. And again, these are types of statutes which are by no means purely unique to Wisconsin. But to give an example, just a little bit of background on how they were doing the fake elector scheme. Importantly, it consisted of having what they felt was an alternative slate of electors. And in Wisconsin's case, they actually prepared the fake documents, and these were not the official ones. And they convened a group together in secret.
Was that the meeting at the Capitol on December 14th, 2020?
That is correct. And so in doing that, that gives rise to a number of possible violations under Wisconsin law. First of all, preparing these documents could be considered an act of forgery, because forgery, as we all think of in terms of forging a check, is you're putting out a fake check, or you're putting someone's name on it representing an authority which is untrue. So that's one possible violation. There's also the violation of falsely assuming to act as a public officer, that long title, but it sort of speaks for itself. And there's one of simulating legal process. And again, the name, as it suggests, is it's pretending to be a legal process, but in fact, it's not. So those are a few of the violations that can arise under Wisconsin law. And there's a few ones like conspiracy, as well as an attempt type crime. Those are generic, no matter what the substantive violation is. So you can conspire with someone to try to do something illegal, so that could be charged. And important to note here that in crimes, it does not matter if you succeed. So for example, to use an easy example, you can go try to rob a bank and it's still gonna be a crime whether or not you succeed in robbing the bank. So here, were they to charge these as criminal violations, even though the plan didn't succeed, it could still be even charged as an attempt.
That helps, I think, paint a picture with that bank example, but that also leads to what's at stake here? What would have happened to the U.S. democratic process if the fake elector plot had succeeded?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's it could have had a very profound effect on the process, and it really could have changed the outcome of the election. But as you look at the big picture, particularly now that we have the full, well, almost the full findings of the January 6th committee, you can also see that part of the plan here was really to stall and to throw the process into disarray. So it wasn't so much that the plan was, oh, we're going to have these different slate of electors come in, and then the process is simply going to allow former President Trump to win instead of Biden. This was part of a process to basically stall and put the normal electoral college certification process into disarray, with the plan that they were banking on the idea that then Vice President Pence might step in and say, stop the count, meaning the Electoral College count, and hopefully put that into such chaos that perhaps it would have to go to the House to decide it, or as former President Trump seemed to believe, and some of their theories were, that Pence himself could act as a substantive decider of the election at that point. So the idea was to say, look, there's confusion here. This is the alternative slate. These people should be recognized. This is a scenario where they suggested, this is wrong and we can talk about it, but they suggested that there had been a previous precedent for that in the 1960 election with Kennedy in Hawaii. They tried to claim that there was a similar situation that had gone on, which is quite incorrect, and it was different. But the idea was to sow a lot of confusion so that that certification process could be stalled and hopefully, you know, in their view, changed.
Sowing confusion. Criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor Shan Wu co-authored this report on the fake elector scheme, using Wisconsin as a type of blueprint for how states could proceed in criminal prosecutions. Colin, with your feelings on whether there should be a criminal investigation into the efforts to overturn Wisconsin's 2020 election results, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We unpack the fake electors scheme, how to prosecute or not dozens of fake electors in seven states, including Wisconsin, who made a last-ditch attempt to keep former President Donald Trump in power. Call in on how you think Wisconsin prosecutors should handle fake electors. The number is 800-642-1234. Shan Wu is a former federal prosecutor, now in private practice. He co-authored a Wisconsin case study on fake electors and stays with us. Let's bring in Jan in Green Bay. Jan, hi. What are your thoughts?
I'm just curious as to how they could not be prosecuted for less than a handful of people to change the vote for the people of Wisconsin has to be illegal. And I think that we have some politicians. I was told that one of the congressmen before he left helped set this up. Now, if that's true, why is he not being prosecuted? And our senator supposedly knew about this and was willing to go through with it till somebody started questioning it.
Jan, thank you. I just want to pause here and allow Shan to jump in, referring to U.S. Senator Ron Johnson there. Shan, what are your thoughts on, what would happen next time and the implications of other people who are not named as the 10 individuals?
Yeah, I think very good question with regard to what type of accountability is there for members of Congress who might have been involved. I think the January 6th committee did a really great job, the speed and how comprehensive the investigation was. Where it does seem a little bit light, though, is the focus on members of Congress and the fact that many of them who may have been involved, you don't have the kind of testimony you have from them as you did from members of the executive branch, Trump's inner circle, even though many of them may have tried to dance a little bit, were taken to the fifth, et cetera. There's not as much scrutiny that's been put on members of Congress. Why that is, it's a little bit speculative. Maybe that, Congress is not too good at necessarily investigating itself. And in terms of the prosecution issue, that's a very interesting legal situation. From a discretion standpoint, DOJ may be reluctant to take on members of Congress, certainly like their great caution in actually deciding whether to prosecute Trump or not. They really want all their T's crossed and I's dotted before they take on that type of investigation. From a state prosecution level, there could be some defenses that members of Congress try to raise. You saw that in the Fulton County, Georgia investigation that's going on, where, for example, some members tried to raise, you can't even question me because that's all part of my legislative process. Those efforts failed. But there are a couple more obstacles that could be raised when the state tries to prosecute or investigate federal officials. So that may account for some of the lighter treatment of that. But in terms of the culpability, once that evidence is developed, there's no reason why they shouldn't be looked at.
And as we see more of these transcript interviews coming out from the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack. We also saw they included in the report text messages from the former chairman of the Republican Party of Wisconsin, Andrew Hitt, worried about the fake elector plan. He still signed on as one of the 10 false electors. What are your thoughts on Hitt's reported doubts?
I think that his reported doubts were not uncommon. I think that they were aware of how much pressure was being exerted for them to do this. And as they began to actually do it, they were realizing that this could be illegal. I think the biggest reason for the doubt probably was the whole fact that they were meeting in secret. This was not something that looked like they were going to do a legitimate function. It didn't look like there was a big massive legal dispute in Wisconsin at that point, and they weren't being above board in what they were doing. So I think quite naturally, anyone who is thinking will realize, you know, this does not smell too good at the moment.
Talking about the fake electors for Trump in Wisconsin in 2020 election, Shan Wu, D.C. attorney, former federal prosecutor, new case study on Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Andy is with us in Appleton. Andy, hi. What would you like to ask?
2 points, if I can squeeze them in. One is, usually when I go hunting, it takes hours and hours of preparation. When I actually pull the trigger for a harvest, it's a very small, but one of the most important parts of hunting. Ron Johnson tried to say he was only a traitor to democracy for 5 seconds as he tried to deliver the fake electors. But it's one of the most important parts. So I don't think that statement of only a short period of time gets him off the hook. As far as the fake electors go, this is my second point. I thought Michigan was prosecuting their fake electors at the local level.
You thought Michigan was prosecuting fake electors. Shan, can you first address that in terms of what other states are doing?
Yeah, I'm actually not familiar with that particular action that Michigan's taking. It's possible there's something going on, but I'm not familiar with that. Certainly, we all know that Georgia has been looking at Trump's effort to influence that. And as part of that, that special grand jury has included seeking testimony from a number of people, which would touch upon the idea of having an alternative slate as well. I do want to say that that analogy to the hunting harvesting is a very good one. Certainly someone cannot use a defense that says, oh, I was only part of this conspiracy for a moment, and that means that I should be not held accountable, particularly when the moment that you're part of it is such a critical one.
Just a moment here. If the U.S. Justice Department is acting on the dozens of fake electors, poring over transcripts and other items the January 6th committee collected, then can Wisconsin be running like a parallel investigation into these same people?
Yes, they can be. And that is something that is actually quite common because there are scenarios where the Justice Department and the state prosecutors will be looking at the same set of circumstances, but there are state crimes and federal crimes being investigated and perhaps ultimately charged, and they can certainly work in parallel. People may wonder, oh, would that be double jeopardy, that there's both a state prosecution and a federal? And it's not. It's not double jeopardy because those are two separate sovereigns that are prosecuting. So that's not a double jeopardy issue. There's also situations where they won't work independently, each pursuing their own prosecutions, but there'll be a joint prosecution, joint task force, for example. We hear about that a lot in violent crimes, drug investigations, where the feds and the state people, you know, work together. So that's another possibility as well.
Shan, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Happy to be here.
Shan Wu is a criminal defense attorney, former federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C., co-authored the report Wisconsin Case Study, The Potential for State Prosecutions of False Electors. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.